There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
Hello there. I'm Ann Thompson, editor-at-large for IndieWire.
And I'm IndieWire's deputy film editor, Ryan Latanzio.
And we're the co-hosts of IndieWire's weekly Screen Talk podcast.
Join us each week for an in-depth discussion of the latest in film and TV industry news with special guests along the way, including filmmakers and executives.
Hear from us every Friday morning on iHeart platforms or wherever you get your podcasts as IndieWire shares what we've learned from the movie week that was.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Now here's a highlight from Coast to Coast AM on iHeartRadio.
And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Matthew Crawford is a mechanic, author of Shop Class at Southcraft. He is also author of the latest book called Why We Drive, which is an incredible book. The latest book, of course, is about, you know, his philosophy of the open road. He majored in physics at UC Santa Barbara, earned a PhD in political philosophy from the University of Chicago. And Matthew, I got to believe you love driving cars, don't you?
I do. Thanks for having me on the show, George. Yeah, cars, motorcycles, skateboards, you name it.
What was the first car you ever owned?
First car I had was a 1963 Beetle, and I bought it before I even had a driver's license. I was already working at a Porsche shop, just doing kind of menial labor. And a VW Bug was about as close as I was going to get to a Porsche.
Mine was a 1968 Ford Mustang, brand new. Dad worked at Ford Motor Company in Dearborn, and he got a substantial discount, and he said, this is going to be for your high school graduation present. And he buys me this beautiful blue Mustang, which I wish I still kept.
Nice.
Those were fun times. Tell me about your work and what you've been doing.
Well, I've just written this book, Why We Drive, and it's a number of things. I guess I'm just very intrigued by driving. I think it's an interesting activity that calls on a lot of human capacities that we don't always think about. It just, you know, becomes kind of automatic. I guess what prompted the inquiry partly was this big push for driverless cars.
Oh, boy. I know.
Yeah.
Well, you just heard that study I just had, that these driverless cars aren't all that they're, you know, made up to be.
Yeah, there's been a lot of hype surrounding this. And one thing that's become clear is that the push for driverless cars is not a response to consumer demand. It's not like people are clamoring for this. It's more of a top-down project. So, like when Pew has asked, done surveys asking people about their attitudes, they still don't trust the technology. Also, when you ask people if they like to drive or think it's a chore, about a third think it's a chore and about two-thirds seem to enjoy it.
Next hour, we're going to open up our phone lines, Matthew, and one of the groups I'm going to ask to call you are truck drivers, because there's also that big movement for driverless trucks.
Yep.
And is this an effort to save money? I mean, why would they even think about driverless vehicles? What's the benefit?
Well, you mentioned trucks there. It seems like, I mean, obviously the point is to get rid of truck drivers.
Yeah.
But more broadly, there's this premise that human beings are terrible drivers. That's what you hear. And, you know, so it's a kind of technocratic project to idiot-proof everything, and they proceed by treating us like idiots. And there's a kind of vicious circle here where the more you automate things, the more our skills atrophy for lack of use, which leads to demands for further automation. So, you know, at the end point of that trajectory, we're just kind of passive and dependent creatures.
Somewhere in the great unknown, somebody came up with the initial idea for driverless vehicles. Who might that have been? Do we know?
Oh, boy. I mean, you could go all the way back to, like, the Jetsons cartoon, right? I mean,
yeah, well.
And something we've been imagining forever, and somehow we identify it with the future. What happened to jetpacks, though? Because personally, I would love
Those would have been fun.
Yeah.
I'd end up probably burning my hiney with one of those things, but wouldn't it be great to be able to just go, and you're where are you going to get? But think about if you ever got into an accident with somebody else up there, you're gone, unless you had a parachute.
Yeah, I don't think we're ready for jetpacks. We've become too dumb.
But I mean, is there an economic? Well, let's push the truck drivers aside for a moment. Is there an economic benefit to the passenger driverless cars?
Well, I mean, think about it. These cars are going to be very expensive. Part of those costs will be a public cost because what we're talking about is really redoing the whole road infrastructure to accommodate these things.
Won't they need some kind of electrical system in the pavement?
Well, there are going to be a bunch of sensors in the pavement, you know, that they'll pick up as they go along. And the thing is that all the sort of promised gains in traffic flow, which is, you know, that's a real possibility, to realize those gains, you have to have essentially everybody in a driverless car because they have to coordinate with one another. And you can't have, you know, people like you and me dashing in between them in their Mustang and messing up the whole thing. So it kind of pushes toward all or nothing. There was this one incident where a Google car came up to an intersection, and it came to a stop. It was a four-way stop. And so it was waiting for the other cars to come to a complete stop before going through because, you know, it's a rule follower. It's a robot. But, of course, that's not what people do. They don't come to a complete stop. So the car got paralyzed. It just sort of froze and melted down there. And the head Google guy in charge, he said that what he had learned from this is that human beings need to be less idiotic.
Oh.
By which he meant they need to act more like robots. And that's, I think that's a conclusion that comes very easily if you regard the mind as basically an inferior version of a computer.
What about the poor woman back in March of 2018, the 49-year-old lady from Arizona who gets killed by a self-driving Uber car because it wasn't able to recognize that the pedestrian had a jaywalk and was, jaywalking and, you know, hit the lady and killed her?
Yeah, there's been a few of those incidents. But think about how much pressure there is to be first to market with this stuff, because whoever gets there first is going to be basically a monopoly, because it's one of these sort of platform type.
Is it going to happen, Matthew?
I think it's way off, and I think there's enough kind of skepticism building now. I think some of the investors are starting to pull out, and we're realizing just how expensive and kind of unnecessary this is because, in fact, human beings are pretty good at doing this. We've figured it out.
And I, you know, happen to like getting into a car when I drive, taking some time to think about my day's events, what I'm going to do while I'm paying attention to traffic, and knock on wood, things have been safe. But I like driving. I think it's relaxing, don't you?
Yeah. Think about a road trip where you may not even have a definite destination in mind, but there's this kind of throwing yourself out into the world. You're roaming. And I find roaming like the best kind of antidote to the confinement of work and family. And, you know, there's something about getting out on the road that it just kind of rejuvenates you.
Technically, Matthew, how do driverless vehicles work? You get in it. What happens?
Well, they're bristling with sensors, like a dozen cameras, LIDAR, which is a form of radar, basically, sound sensors, and then each one of these has to be basically a rolling supercomputer to process all this data in real time. And we're talking just gobs and gobs of data.
Are they electric or gasoline?
Oh, well, they could be either. You know, the type of power plant they have is sort of irrelevant to the driverless aspect of it. Yeah.
Who fills up the tank if it's got gasoline needs?
Well,
the driverless driver? I mean, what happens? We're going to have driverless gasoline stations one day too?
Yeah, you see, questions like that, I don't think it's all been worked out.
And how does the car start? I mean, our car now, you got a key or a push button, you start your car and off you go. I mean, how's the car going to start?
Yeah, maybe it'll be like a computer where you push the start button both to stop it and to start it.
And who's going to start it?
Yeah, well, I don't know. Presumably the operator would have some control.
What operator? I mean, what if you have an Uber out there? Where's it coming from? Who's going to start it up? Who's going to stop it?
Yeah. Well, you're asking the right questions. And you mentioned Uber. So one effect of Uber and the other ride-hailing apps has been a big increase in congestion. Because think about it. You know, a car shows up within a few minutes, almost like magic. And the only way they're able to do that is to flood the streets with cars. And in New York City, from 2013 to 17, when the city was sort of getting Uberized, the number of for-hire vehicles increased by 59%, and the number of unoccupied vehicles went up by 81%.
Jeez.
So the, you know, like the New York City Transportation Department is very upset about this, and for good reason. And then meanwhile, the subway is crumbling, right, for lack of investment.
Has Uber killed the cab business? I don't know what the numbers are, but
well,
I'm just
certainly tried. Yeah, and unless this, you know, the various jurisdictions step up and try to offer some kind of
protection.
Yeah, a more sort of even competitive playing field. And the thing about it is, so Ubers are super cheap, right? They're often about half the price of a cab.
Yes, exactly.
So you ask, how is that possible? Well, a transportation consultant did a study of Uber's economics and discovered that the only reason they can charge such low fares is because of massive subsidies by the early investors. So in other words, the investors are paying your fare, or about half of it. And it's not like Uber has discovered efficiencies that previously eluded the taxi industry. So later investors, now, you know, the company sort of grew exponentially, and that attracts further investment. And so basically, at that point, it becomes like a Ponzi scheme with later investors, you know,
taking out the ones that came in.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, man, that's something else. And then, you know, Lyft jumped in. But who is asleep at the cab companies who should have come up with an Uber-type app for Yellow Cab and places like that?
Yeah, no, you're right. Because it's not like a complicated technology. It isn't really a technology that's doing this. It's more a form of kind of labor arbitrage where you're taking these sort of gig economy drivers who aren't really invested in the job. Furthermore, they're usually leasing their cars, and they get tied into these often pretty abusive lease agreements that it's very hard to get out of. And so now you're basically like a sharecropper working for Uber. And, you know, they're often immigrants. They're not very savvy financially, so they don't quite know what they're getting into.
Right. But they need a job. They need quick money. And it's a quick way to do it because I'm told by some of the drivers that Uber or Lyft just pops the money in their bank account and it's there.
Yeah. Yep.
Now, in your book, you talk about you've traveled around to different scenes and places like that. What have you find in the book, Why We Drive? What was the most exciting aspect of it for you?
Yeah, so I went to different motorsport scenes. This is sort of grassroots motorsport, small stuff, and different kind of automotive subcultures. And one thing that was very attractive is that, like in this desert race they do in Nevada, it's been going on for generations. It's the same families come back and they man these race checkpoints, like the same checkpoints. You know, it'd be fathers and daughters, you know, sort of passing this on. And they have a very keen sense of being responsible, not just for the desert, but for, you know, the relationship with the townspeople and the ranchers. And it's this activity they love. And it's this picture of self-government, really, because there's no bureaucracy, there's no referee to appeal to when, you know, something goes wrong. It's just people kind of working things out. And that was, I thought that was a nice kind of glimpse into what you might call like the sort of the nursery of the democratic character, when people just learn to cooperate and work it out.
Matthew, you've got an issue with speed limits and red light cameras. I don't like red light cameras, but speed limits don't bother me. Why does it bother you?
Well, not speed limits in general, but the thing is, they're often set below the sort of reasonable speed that's dictated by the features of the road. In fact, the former head of the National Transportation Safety Administration, after he quit that job, he published a paper in which he said that most speed limits in America are set about 15 miles an hour too slow. And it's interesting because the speed that people actually drive is not very sensitive to the speed limit. We tend to take our cues from, for example, the width of the lanes. And there's actually a standard for, you know, if it's a 55 mile an hour speed limit, you have a certain lane width. And, you know, if it's narrower, you got to go slower because it's harder to stay near the center of the lane. Well, to take an example, the George Washington Parkway in D.C., the lanes are built to the 55 mile an hour standard, but the speed limit is 45. So people are driving, you know, faster, and the speed limit is deliberately set in order to sort of maximize infractions, and it's a notorious speed trap.
We've got a situation that because of COVID-19, so many people are outside of their houses jogging and walking their dogs and stuff because they're tired of being cooped up. But at a certain time, going west in my neighborhood, the sun is just notorious at 4 or 5 o'clock. And if you've got hundreds of people out jogging and walking and stuff, a lot of them, Matthew, don't really pay attention to you, and so they'll just walk right across the street. And I got to tell you, with the sun hitting you right in the eyes, yeah, and all these people out there, you got to be really careful because you can't see these people. I mean, it's so easy to hit somebody.
Yeah, there's really no substitute for paying attention, and that's a big crisis, right? Is distracted driving, because once the smartphone came along,
oh my God,
you know,
yeah.
It's like this dopamine candy coming at you, and the windshield just starts to seem like one more screen, but it can't compete with the stuff that's on your phone. So that's a real problem.
Listen to more Coast to Coast AM every weeknight at 1 a.m. Eastern, and go to coasttocoastam.com for more.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic, that's a literal pro, and it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having pink lady apple, berry lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Hello there. I'm Ann Thompson, editor-at-large for IndieWire.
And I'm IndieWire's deputy film editor, Ryan Latanzio.
And we're the co-hosts of IndieWire's weekly Screen Talk podcast.
Join us each week for an in-depth discussion of the latest in film and TV industry news with special guests along the way, including filmmakers and executives.
Hear from us every Friday morning on iHeart platforms or wherever you get your podcasts as IndieWire shares what we've learned from the movie week that was.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.